Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1400 hours GMT on Monday the 7th of July, these are our main stories. A former Congolese general known as the Terminator has been found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Amnesty International says the Philippines government is running a large-scale murdering enterprise with its war on drugs. British Airways is facing a record fine of nearly $230 million over a data breach. Also,
we believe the public has the right to see what is happening to the painting, how we carry out the research.
The rare Rembrandt restoration that's going public. 4 years after his trial began at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, the former Congolese militia commander Bosco Ntaganda has been found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The man, known as the Terminator, was also found guilty of recruiting and using child soldiers during the long-running conflict in Ituri province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The former child soldier had denied the charges. The presiding judge at the ICC in The Hague, Robert Fremer, said Ntaganda bore responsibility for crimes committed by his troops.
In addition to direct orders to target and kill enemy, including civilians, Mr. Ntaganda endorsed criminal conduct of his soldiers by way of his own conduct. Moreover, with his own actions, he showed his troops how the orders were to be implemented with regard to the treatment of Flandu civilians.
Our correspondent Anna Holligan was in court in The Hague as the verdict was read out.
Just gruesome details given by the judge outlining the reign of terror that was executed by Bosco Ntaganda and his rebel forces. They had to decide, really, whether he had been integral to the planning of these massacres that had taken place between 2002 and 2003. And they found that he was instrumental. In some cases, he was involved. In others, he was involved in just the planning of the attack. So on one village, for example, deciding to attack from two sides. It was described as an ethnic war, trying to wipe out rival ethnic groups in this mineral-rich region of Ituri for control of those gold mines, for example. But just the description matched with some of the images that we'd seen throughout the course of this trial. So quite early on, the prosecution showed pictures of mutilated bodies, women and children who'd been disemboweled by the rebels. And there was a discussion early on of how the rebel forces had to be treated for sexually transmitted diseases. Such was the scale of the sexual abuse that took place. And two distinctive features of this case in particular is that Bosco Ntaganda was the first ever suspect to voluntarily surrender to the ICC, and the other is that he is the first suspect here to be found guilty of sexual crimes, and that in itself will mean a lot, not just to the victims who have fought for justice for years, but also to the prosecutor who has made this one of the real key elements of her rule here at the ICC, to try to recognise this rather horrible phrase, rape as a weapon of war, and its role in targeting women but also tearing communities apart.
And Anna, what about sentencing?
Well, that's what comes next. So Bosco Ntaganda has 30 days to launch an appeal. Once they have reached a final verdict, they will start to hear from some of the victims, some of the survivors, and then reach a decision on the sentencing. We know the prosecutors have said it will help the victims to put the past behind them and build a better future if he is given the maximum 30-year term. That is obviously at the judge's discretion. We also know he was taken into custody in March 2013, so that's 6 years he's already spent in ICC custody, and if previous cases are anything to go on, that would be taken off any ultimate jail term he was given.
Anna Holligan.
What you say, years και ομολουσίου και αδιαιρέτου Τριάδος.
Το όνομα της Αγίας, ομολουσίας και αδιαιρέτου Τριάδος.
That was the scene in Athens, where the new Prime Minister of Greece, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, has been sworn in. In his first address, since winning an outright majority in Sunday's snap election, he promised to be a leader for all Greeks.
I feel that I have a strong mandate to deliver on my agenda, which is an agenda to grow the economy, to create more jobs, but also to make sure that the Greek people feel safe again.
Mr. Mitsotakis's centre-right New Democracy Party made big gains, sweeping the radical left-wing party Syriza, who famously tried and failed to resist austerity, from power. Our correspondent Mark Lowen spoke to me from Athens, and I asked him what Mr. Mitsotakis's approach would be.
I think he's not going to overpromise, Val. He's going to be careful to have learnt the lessons from the man he ousted, Alexis Tsipras, who kind of promised the earth in 2015 to reject austerity and tear up Greece's bailout, and then he was forced into a humiliating U-turn. So Kyriakos Mitsotakis says that he wants to lower some taxes, he wants to spearhead privatisation, move further forward with that, he wants to create more secure long-term jobs, but he's very aware that Greece's financial situation remains precarious. Growth has returned, but it is sluggish, about 2% still last year and this year. And there is still a huge uphill struggle as Greece remains out of its bailout, but under strict financial supervision. So he will take his time, I think, and he will make promises that are rooted much more in reality rather than the kind of huge promises which his predecessor made in 2015 and which he was forced to break.
And do you think that's the lesson from what happened to the Syriza party?
Yeah, I think Alexis Tsipras knows that his undoing was making promises that he couldn't keep. He will now regroup in opposition. He's still young. He's 44 years old. He's emerged very much as the strongest leftist figure in Greece. And he will be waiting in the wings, ready to pounce if Mitsotakis makes a misstep. This is not, this is by no means the last that Greece will have heard of Alexis Tsipras. And yet, he made several errors in office. He, as I say, broke many of the promises. He was seen to have kind of become the Brussels establishment that he was fighting against initially. There was a huge scandal when he was seen sunbathing on a luxury Greek yacht, smoking cigars just weeks after those devastating forest fires last year, which he was widely seen to have mismanaged. There were charges of hypocrisy that were levelled against him. I think the widespread feeling here, perhaps even among some of his supporters, is it's time for a new era. He will go into opposition. And let's see whether Mitsotakis can take Greece forward and give Greeks the hope that this country so desperately craves.
Mark Lowen in Athens. Amnesty International has described the violent crackdown on drugs in the Philippines as a large-scale murdering enterprise and has called for a UN investigation. In a new report, Amnesty warned that a programme of killings begun by President Rodrigo Duterte had continued unabated with thousands of deaths and said there was now a perilous normalisation of illegal executions. The head of Amnesty International in the Philippines, Butch Olano, said the war on drugs had cost thousands of lives.
There have been 6,600 killings or drug personalities killed from July 2016 to May 2019. That's a total of around 6 killings per day. But if you add the 23,000 killings under the so-called deaths under investigation or homicide under investigation, you should add another 21 killings or a total of about 27 killings per day. But the numbers really don't matter anymore. What is important is that enough have been killed. Not one more should be killed.
Rachel Choa Howard, Philippines researcher at Amnesty International, told Dan Damon what they'd found.
We have been carrying out new research in the Philippines in the context of the war on drugs because killings continue to occur across the country on a daily basis. Basically, the government insists that every suspected drug offender that it kills resists arrest, and therefore they act in self-defense. But our research shows that almost all the time this type of narrative is completely shut down and contested by the families that we speak to, who tell us that these people were never arrested and gunned down in cold blood.
Is the war on drugs in the Philippines working, actually?
Well, if you consider that creating a climate of fear and creating a climate in which killings can be carried out by police and others, you know, with impunity as working, then perhaps. But if this is a situation which has created an environment in which police are completely above the law. We've seen police killings rise in an area called Central Luzon, which is north of Metro Manila. And this has happened because senior police officers who were previously serving in positions of command in Metro Manila when large numbers of police killings were happening have moved over there. So not only have police, you know, been able to get away with these types of murders, but they have also been promoted and rewarded for this kind of behavior.
I accept that, and there's no doubting that the violence is extreme and in many cases disputed by the families. I just wondered if you were able to offer any insight, because President Duterte himself, when he was mayor of Davao City, he organized a kind of liquidation squad, didn't he? Did it reduce the amount of drugs available in the city or not?
Well, we don't comment on, you know, what exactly the effect of such violent policies are in terms of the actual amount of drugs in the country. But we know that punitive and repressive policies in the past have failed to address drug-related problems. They have a legacy of violence and suffering. And we believe that the Philippine authorities must put an end to this massive spate of killings immediately and implement an evidence-based drug policy focused on health and human rights. Those who require drug dependence treatment should have access to health services. The government should end its punitive approach, and that's one reason we're calling for a UN investigation into the situation, given that the government has failed to act at all.
Rachel Choa Howard from Amnesty International. It is without doubt one of the most famous paintings in the world, and it's in desperate need of a spot of tender loving care. Rembrandt's The Night Watch is undergoing its most comprehensive ever restoration at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. But this restoration isn't just the biggest, it's also the first to be live streamed and open to the public. Thaco Dibbets is the museum's director.
The Night Watch belongs to the Netherlands, to everybody, to the world. We believe the public has the right to see what is happening to the painting, how we carry out the research. It is very exciting, an adventure, because we don't yet know what the outcome of the research will be. We want to share this with everybody.
Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd told me more.
They're restoring one of the great paintings by one of the greatest painters, maybe the greatest painting by Rembrandt. The Night Watch is regarded generally as a huge masterpiece. Everyone who goes to the museum wants to see the Night Watch. And now the Rijksmuseum has created a sort of set so that people who are there in Amsterdam can watch Operation Night Watch. It's all in a big glass box. Perhaps more importantly in this regard, you can watch it all live on the Rijksmuseum website for however long this takes. It's going to be a long, long process. I should point out, however, that the process is very, very slow.
What kind of process is it? Because it's quite unusual, isn't it?
Yes, experts think aspects of the painting are changing, for instance, in the whitening of the figure of a little dog. So initially, it's a process of research. Well, it's 377 years old, so it's not surprising work needs to be done. This study stage is needed to find the best way forward. People will not be in the glass box sploshing paint about for a long time, if indeed ever. They're trying to form a very exact picture of the picture, so to speak. There may be layers of paint and varnish which aren't really understood, because people didn't used to study paintings in this way and the technology wasn't there.
Why is it needed in particular? You said it's old, but it was also damaged, wasn't it?
It was damaged in the 70s by being attacked. One has to say that was actually repaired, but this is an enormously important painting for the Rijksmuseum. It's, so to speak, their Mona Lisa. It's maybe the great masterpiece of the Dutch Golden Age. So many artists since have admired Rembrandt's handling of light. It really is the most fantastic painting. You know, when some people say, oh, it's a masterpiece, you think, yeah, it's kind of a masterpiece. No, this is a masterpiece.
Vincent Dowd. Still to come in this podcast.
Hi, I'm Erica. Nice to meet you.
From farming to newsreading, the robot revolution in Japan. British Airways is facing a fine of nearly $230 million for a breach of its website security systems last year. The authorities in the UK said the penalty was a record for the country and the first to be made under new European data protection rules, known as GDPR. The sum represents around 1.5% of BA's global turnover. BA says it will appeal against the decision. Travel expert Simon Calder explains the background.
In 2018, British Airways chairman and chief executive Alex Cruz revealed that hundreds of thousands of passengers on British Airways had had their credit card data stolen. It was a fairly old school attack. Somebody just went in, cyber criminals, and took the credit card numbers, the expiry dates, and crucially, the three-digit security code or card verification value that customers had tapped in. Now, under the GDPR rule, they could be fined up to 4% of their revenue in 2017. Now, that was $15 billion, so they could conceivably have had to pay over $600 million. As it is, they have been landed with this fine, which works out over $5 for every passenger they're expecting to fly on British Airways this year.
Simon Calder. The Ebola outbreak in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo is now almost a year old. It's already claimed the lives of more than 1,500 people. The international medical response has checked the progress of the virus, saving many lives. But it's not contained the disease that many fear could now spread south from the provinces to the regional capital of Goma, which is situated on the border with Rwanda. From there, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports.
I'm standing on the shores of Lake Kivu, one of the great lakes of Central Africa. Behind me lies Goma, one of the largest cities in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's a lovely setting. Yet Goma is a city under threat. To the south, the lake contains dangerous levels of lethal methane, and to the north lies an active volcano. And now there's a new threat, Ebola. And people here are worried, like Sylvie and Martin, enjoying Sunday morning with their daughter, Eliana.
If it comes to Goma, it will be a catastrophe. Some people are not concerned, but it does concern me.
We flew north of Goma to Butembo, at the heart of the outbreak that's already killed more than 1,500 people over the last 11 months. This is the front line against the disease, a pop-up vaccination centre for the family and neighbours of a woman who died this morning, just part of the huge international medical response that is saving lives, but not containing the virus that some fear could head south.
Well, it's a present danger, frankly. It could be here any day.
David Gressley is the United Nations Emergency Response Coordinator for Ebola.
There's a lot of work in terms of vaccination to try to create a firewall, a lot of work in terms of preparedness and surveillance, but these systems can break down, and over time, if it's long enough, probably will break down.
At Goma Hospital, the choir practiced as we visited a small clinic set aside for suspected Ebola cases. There have been no confirmed incidents here yet, but they're already building another treatment centre on the other side of town.
Okay. Yeah.
But after inspecting the facilities, the International Development Secretary, Rory Stewart, was concerned.
I was actually worried by the thermometer checking of temperatures on the entrance to the Goma General Hospital and by the isolation facilities that are available there. So Goma is a big place, millions of people living there. If it gets into that type of area, it's very difficult because Goma really is connected to the world.
We've come to the border between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, but everyone who crosses here, first of all, they wash their hands in buckets of chlorinated water. Once that's happened, they then move off to have their temperature checked. And there's a lady here with a thing that looks a bit like a gun.
Move your glasses.
I take my glasses off. So my temperature, that looks good. It's 36.5, so that's good. So it's an infrared laser that bounces into my skin, takes the temperature, bounces back, and makes the recording.
Not your brain.
Not my brain.
Not your brain.
You wouldn't want to do that.
Not your brain.
And what's astonishing is that this border sees between 18 and 20,000 people crossing every single day. And if it was closed because of Ebola, it would have a devastating impact on the economy, destroying the livelihoods of small traders who cross each day. But not all here are so pessimistic, such as Anne-Marie Loof from Doctors Without Borders.
I mean, if it comes here, we're talking many thousands potentially dying, not just, you know, just over 8,000.
We know already for 8 or 9 months that there is this outbreak, so we are already preparing. So seriously, I am a bit more optimistic than thousands and thousands, but it could be quite big.
In a packed bar in Goma, there's a big football game going on. Everyone's watching the action. And yet, even here, there are small TV screens showing health information films about the danger of infection. In some ways, Ebola has already arrived in the city.
James Landale in Goma. Here in Britain, the businesswoman, charity campaigner and former wife of Sir Paul McCartney, Heather Mills, has received an apology and substantial damages after settling her case against the News of the World newspaper over phone hacking. In a statement outside the High Court in London, she said she felt joy and vindication and criticised what she called the targeted smear campaign waged against her and other victims by News Group newspapers. Our correspondent Keith Doyle was in court.
This marks the end of this privacy case between News Group newspapers and Heather Mills. It has been settled with that apology in court and an undisclosed level of settlement funds. We don't know exactly how much that was, but Heather Mills said that this was the largest settlement of its type. And this case was brought covering a 9-year period between 1999 and 2008, when around 140 stories appeared in the News of the World, where Heather Mills claimed that she had been hacked. There was no other way that these stories could have got out. One of the stories is thought to have been a row between her and Paul McCartney over a wedding ring. Now, she said that these stories that were leaked, they caused a seriously corrosive effect on her relationships with her friends and family. It affected her work with her landmine charity. Now, outside court, after the settlement, she made this statement.
After my separation in 2006, the hounding by the media was incessant. For a long time, I was a prisoner in my own home as reporters camped at the end of my road for 2 years.
Well, in court, News Group newspapers made a statement. They said, if I can just read a short bit of it to you, said it offers its sincere apologies to Mrs. Heather Mills and Miss Fiona Mills for the distress caused to them by the invasion of their privacy by individuals working for or on behalf of News of the World. The News Group newspapers accepts that such activity should never have taken place. Well, as I say, that marks the end of this particular case. So far, the hacking cases have cost News Group newspapers in the region of £500 million. Now, that could double to £1 billion as many more cases are in the pipeline. So this hacking story may be finished here for Heather Mills, but it still has a long way to run.
Keith Doyle. The Turkish lira has fallen by as much as 2% today after President Erdogan's controversial decision over the weekend to fire the country's central bank governor. No official reason was given for the sacking, but it comes amid reports of disagreements over interest rates, which the government wants to lower in a bid to boost economic growth. İbrahim Çürhan is a former governor of Turkey's central bank.
When you remove the central bank governor, it means that there is no guarantee for the new appointee to be able to, you know, function independently. Because if you do something that is in contradiction with the government policies, you can be removed as well. If we see, you know, more aggressive rate cuts, then I think there is a significant risk for Turkish lira to depreciate abruptly.
İbrahim Çürhan, former governor of Turkey's central bank. Japan, like many developed nations, has a growing number of old people and a scarcity of young workers to power its economy. Now the government has come up with a plan to deal with the crisis by getting more women into the labour force, by welcoming more foreign workers and by building robots. So, is automation the answer? The newsroom's Stephanie Hegarty reports.
Hi, I'm Erica. Nice to meet you.
You too.
Where are you from?
This small room down a winding corridor, high up in the Nippon TV tower, is where Erica Aoi lives. She's one of Nippon TV's newest stars and the first robot TV presenter in the world.
Welcome to the BBC. I'm Erica Aoi. Today's news.
She's eerily perfect, with light, rubbery skin and shiny hair, and she's perched with impossibly good posture on a white leather armchair.
The president was promised a visit.
Erica mines the internet to learn how to speak, but her conversation skills still need some work.
Tofu.
I like you.
I like tofu.
I can't eat it.
I'm not sure you can.
I can't eat it.
Okay, if you insist.
Kauai Kawakami, her engineer, says it might be 50 years before Erica can chat like a human.
Wow, this is good.
Some people are worried about the idea of robots replacing us. On a list of humans that would be missed in a robot takeover, though, I'm not sure TV presenters would be too high up there. But would you let a robot look after your children? This is Vivo, a 3-foot-tall, shiny blue robot bear.
So aside from being super cute, Vivo also greets kids when they arrive and takes their temperature. He records how much they've had to eat and how much they've slept, and then he tells the parents that at the end of the day when they come to pick their kids up. Aside from that, at this point, he doesn't do much else.
Joe Sadamatsu set up this group of care homes and nurseries when he was in his 20s. Now it's a multi-million dollar business. But they have one major struggle.
We need more staff. Japan needs to take in more foreigners. Or we have to find more women to work. Or robots.
How long do you think it will be before the whole nursery is run by robots? 15! That's soon!
For the moment, though, Vivo is more of an idea than a revolution. But some robots are ready to shake up industries, like farming.
We're about an hour outside Tokyo, and we've come to the leafy green seaside town of Kamakura. Just outside a traditional wooden Japanese house, there is a patch of dirt, and in that dirt, a small miniature tank-like robot. It's called Inaho, and it's been developed to pick fruits and vegetables.
The robot has this special type of camera, so it will sort of observe the shape, the asparagus, and whether it's long enough so that it can be picked or not.
Shinpei Tobayama is one of Inaho's developers.
And it's projected that within the next 10 years, the number of Japanese farmers are going to decrease by half, actually.
The idea is that this machine will cost a little less than human labor. A robot designed to replace humans could also help smallhold farmers to survive.
Stephanie Hegarty reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.